Ali to be the rightly or the only successor of the Prophet. The incidence of Ghadir is also there. Now the translation, the meaning of Mawla has been changed.
Yes.
But actually the actual wordings is there. Man kunta mawlahu fa aliyun mawla. Now you translate it as a friend or the leader, it depends on you.
Yeah.
All these things are there. The point is, which I want to make for our listeners, is that at this point and in the era in which we are living, in the time which we are living, we need to move towards the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. We need to work on commonalities. There are many disputes in the history. There are many things which are narrated.
We should avoid the disputes.
Muslims get strengthened by unity. We need to call everyone for the unity. These disputes are there. These are there. These are there for those who want the true guidance. They can get their guidance. Everyone have their own proofs. Some people, they bring weak and unauthentic narrations and they try to prove their school of thought. But the point is, being a Muslim, where we are standing today, does on the day of Qiyamah, Allah will ask us that, who did Umm Kulsum married or not? Or he will ask about how you lived in the world you were. Were you united against the enemies of Islam or not? Were you working or were you... did you put all your strengths in order to follow the true Muhammadan Islam or not?
Exactly.
These historical disputes have nothing to do with the beliefs.
Judgments will not be based on these...
And giving someone daughter does not prove that the person has a good relation. As I just mentioned, like Umar ibn al-Khattab, the second caliph, he warned Abbas that I will fill the Zamzam, the well of Zamzam. So even Imam Ali might be forced to give his daughter.
Probably, yes.
Even if she was the daughter of the first caliph from Asma ibn Umais. So all these things are there. But the point is that where we are standing today, and what is our basically duty? That's what we need to think about.
Exactly. Thank you very much for the answer, this question. And of course, we must pay attention to our actions and our practical life rather than these, we can call it like absurd, probably, questions who probably would waste the time of our youth and our generation. So again, we would like to thank you. And we wish for your prosperity and success in this life and in the next world. Many, many thanks to our dear listeners. And may Allah bless you all. Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
European News Bulletin.
Welcome to the Bulletin. Good to have you from the British capital. I'm your host, Amina Taylor, and we kick things off with our top story. The British Parliament is debating the government's police crime sentencing and courts bill aimed at giving law enforcement sweeping powers to deal with protest. But the bill is facing backlash from across the political spectrum as a clampdown on freedom of expression. Saeed Poreza has this one.
The debate over the policing of a London vigil on March 13th For Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old woman allegedly kidnapped and murdered by a serving British police officer earlier this month, is ongoing. What had been a peaceful and respectful demonstration of female solidarity turned ugly. Police moved in, pushing and shoving the demonstrators, and took away some of the women in handcuffs.
I've never been in a situation like this before, so I just thought, well, if I just don't say anything, I'm not sure what to do. But, you know, I just stood there, and I know someone was, a police officer was pulling my arm, trying to get my name, and then all of a sudden, I was tackled to the ground.
The sight of women who had come to stand together against male violence being manhandled led to a chorus of criticism from across the political spectrum.
The Metropolitan Police went to a very peaceful vigil, a protest about mourning the death of a murdered girl, and they reacted extremely heavy-handedly. They whipped the situation up and they made arrests. It was so unnecessary.
Attention soon shifted to this woman, Metropolitan Police Commissioner Cressida Dick, forced to explain her officer's actions to the authorities and to defend herself.
I don't think anybody who was not in the operation can actually pass a detailed comment on the rightness and wrongness of it.
She has so far rejected calls for her resignation from those she described as armchair critics who believe police handling of the vigil was heavy-handed. But she has the backing of the government. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he has full confidence in her. In fact, the force she leads may be getting the powers she asked for after the Extinction Rebellion protests of 2019, a new law and order bill. Critics, among them conservative MPs, have called it a mess and an attack on people's right to protest.
300 or so pages, 170-something clauses, and almost nothing, if you can believe it, on violence against women and girls. The gaping hole in this bill is why we'll be voting against it.
The main focus of the criticism of the bill is its wording. For example, it gives the police the power to impose conditions on processions and public assemblies if the noise generated by the persons taking part may result in serious disruption to the activities of an organization which are carried out in the vicinity.
I'm really worried about it. It gives the police a lot of powers to decide what they think is an unacceptable protest, powers that can be decided later in law. It's not very clear. Just their conception of what might be a public annoyance or nuisance is potentially going to be a reason to shut down a protest and for prison sentences of up to 10 years. That's a bit of an assault on democracy.
Just imagine going to jail for making noise or causing inconvenience. The British government will have some tough questions to answer from MPs on its new policing bill, such as how it defines such unspecified terms as noise or serious inconvenience, and how giving sweeping, ill-defined powers to the police will affect freedom of expression in this country. Saeed Pour is up, London.
There's just so much to unpick in that particular story. So much so that we brought in Richard Saban for this one. And Richard, we're going to break this up because there are so many different elements here. Let's kick off with your first point of order on this story, please.
Yes, indeed, and good to be with you, Amina. So our first headline is talking about the rallying cry at a protest which took place last night. And that cry was, protect women, not statues. And so we saw the second protest for Sarah Everard in recent days, and we saw quite incredible scenes by most people's understanding of the police literally surrounding a statue of Winston Churchill. And, you know, this kind of outraged protesters. And of course, in recent days, we saw the rather troubling footage emerge from a protest in the Clapham area where, you know, male police were literally physically manhandling and, you know, removing protesters who were attending a vigil for Sarah Everard. And of course, you know, Sarah Everard, it's believed, died at the hands of Wayne Cousins, who now faces charges. It's alleged he murdered her. And so public outrage really over the case of Sarah Everard. But of course, the way the police are handling it is really reaching fever pitch. And now, of course, the government and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, were already pushing through this new policing bill, which Saeed Pour Reza just mentioned in his package a moment ago. And of course, the scenes over the last few days, the case of Sarah Everard has really, brought extra scrutiny onto this bill, which, of course, on the one hand, the pretext for it is to give the police extra strength to carry out their duties. But, quite rightly, really, civil liberties activists are saying this takes Britain one step closer to an authoritarian step. Just a cursory reading shows you that things like, for example, using a megaphone outside of Parliament and raising the noise to certain levels could in itself be an offence. So, this is understandably alarming people, Amina.
It is, and this bill is being discussed. Labour, the opposition party, were going to abstain previously, but I think the optics after the weekend's protest and some of those very images that we saw of female protesters being manhandled when they're here to discuss male violence in a lot of the cases and violence against women, it just didn't look good. I think it was very difficult for Keir Starmer to do anything else other than say, vote with your conscience. And most of the Labour Party members who've spoken out about this say they will vote against this bill in its present form. They didn't really have another option here, Richard.
Exactly, and I think there might be an argument that had this bill been, being pushed through at any other time, perhaps it wouldn't be facing the staunch opposition that it is now. It's become a stick to kind of beat the government with, really, by the opposition. And of course, other critics might say that this bill really fits in line with some of Priti Patel's other policies, which, many people are saying are draconian, particularly around issues, for example, like immigration. And so I suppose we'll see in the coming days how these details might be thrashed out and what exactly happens.
Indeed. Perhaps you can get us with the online reaction there, Richard.
Sure. Let's go first to a reaction from Samantha, who says regarding the statue of Churchill, well, it's what we already know. A statue of Winston Churchill is far more important than the safety of women. And Donna Crum, on the topic of the policing bill, says, stop the crackdown on protest in Priti Patel's policing bill. Police chiefs have just shown that they can't be trusted with these powers. Write to your MP now. So strong words on social media there, Amina.
A different aspect to this has been one where people are mindful that the life of Sarah Everard had been lost, but there was a wider picture here about who gets the attention and which faces lead the narrative. Please explain.
Exactly. So let's show the headline here, because many people have picked up the case of Blessing Olusegun, who is a woman, a 21-year-old student, who went missing in Sussex in September of last year, and her body was then later found, I believe, on the beach in the Sussex area. Now, police initially said that the death was unexplained. I believe part of the investigation suggested that Blessing actually drowned. But, the case of Sarah Everard in the last few days has actually brought spotlight onto this case. And actually, there's a petition online which has amassed thousands and thousands of signatures, and they're actually demanding that there's a new investigation into the case of Blessing Olusegun. And actually, there's some kind of rather worrying parallels, really, between her case and Sarah Everard. For example, both women were said to be in communication with their boyfriends, leading up to the time they are believed to have disappeared. And, I think a lot of people are also saying that, look, there's a lot of evidence around the case of Blessing Olusegun, which certainly warrants a new investigation. And of course, the question around what might have happened to her feeds into the wider issue, really, of potential violence against women, it's not safe for them to walk around in places where they should have. And so, this petition's actually gained a lot more signatures over the last few days. I think it will gain more. And actually, if you look online, Amina, tragically, sadly, there's many, many, many cases like this which are now being brought into the spotlight. And people are saying, look, something needs to be done about the climate in which these kinds of incidents can take place. And of course, the backdrop is, of course, the Sarah Everard case. But, you know, within this mix, the police are certainly, you know, under scrutiny for how they're policing the process, but also perhaps even an element of, you know, the investigation itself. A lot of people are saying online.
And who takes what seriously? Let's cut through to some of those online messages, Rich.
Okay, let's go first to Vanessa, who says, "Blessing Olusegun should have gotten the same coverage. To this day, no one knows what happened to her." Charlotte chimes in rather strongly with, "White privilege is so important to understand in these traumatic scenarios. If you're white and hurting this week, just imagine what non-white women are experiencing. White people and the media didn't come out with this clout for Blessing Olusegun. We absolutely need to change that." Sister Space tweets, "I'm so sad about Sarah's murder. I'm a black woman and a mother, yet many will disregard black victims. I didn't even know Blessing Olusegun was missing. Why? Because she's black. We need your continued support to help highlight these injustices."
Indeed. And of course, solace and solidarity with everyone who's missing someone right now, and perhaps those families who got the ultimate bad news. Richard Sudan, thank you very much. Right, we move on now, because Pope Francis has renewed his appeal to all sides in the war on Syria to demonstrate signs of goodwill. This as the conflict passes off the 10-year anniversary.
10 years ago, the bloody conflict in Syria began. It has caused one of the greatest humanitarian catastrophes of our time, an untold number of dead and wounded. I renew my heartfelt appeal to all parties to show signs of goodwill so that a glimmer of hope can be opened for the exhausted population. I also hope for a decisive and renewed commitment on the part of the international community so that the social fabric can be mended to launch reconstruction and economic recovery.
Western powers continue to sanction the Syrian population, with US troops occupying the country's oil fields in the northeast. Hunger and poverty have also been used to pressure the people into submission and regime change. Now, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats have had their worst ever election result in two key regional votes. The CDU have historically enjoyed firm support in Baden-Württemberg and Rhineland-Palatinate, but early results show a marked drop, widely blamed on public anger at the response to the coronavirus pandemic, delays in the vaccine rollout, a steady rise in cases, and a continued lockdown have hit the ruling party hard. Chancellor Merkel is due to step down in September after 16 years in office. The poor election results is the first major test for Armin Laschet, who was elected party leader in January. Now, Kosovo has become the first Muslim country to open an embassy in the occupied holy city of Jerusalem al-Quds. The announcement comes after diplomatic relations were established last month between Tel Aviv and Pristina. Kosovo is the third country after the US and Guatemala to follow suit and make the controversial decision to move its embassy to the occupied area. Now, Jerusalem al-Quds remains a topic of a decades-long dispute, which started after Israel illegally annexed the region during the 1967 war. The Palestinians claim East al-Quds as the capital of their future state. Well, Mohsen Abbas, the political commentator, is with us. And your reaction to this development, Mohsen, what's in it for Kosovo?
Well, initial recognition of Kosovo since its its declaration of independence since February 2008 has been mixed, and the international community is still divided on the issue. The UN, for instance, only about 22 out of 27 European Union countries have actually accepted it. In the UN, it's 51% of the nations which have accepted Kosovo's independence, and so on. So you can see that one of the major needs of Kosovo is recognition. They need to be, acknowledged that they are a legitimate state. Israel coming on board and doing this obviously helps just in itself, but also, of course, Israel has huge influence, backdoor influence with European and other nations, which it could exert in the favor of Kosovo. So I see that as one primary benefit that the Kosovans see that they would get out of doing this. And not only have they had the recognition of Israel, they've also now gone the next stage, which is to say that they want to push their embassy into Jerusalem, only the third embassy to do it, third nation to do it, the U.S. and Guatemala, and now, of course, Kosovo. And it is the first European country to move to Jerusalem with its embassy, and it's the first majority Muslim nation to establish the embassy in the Israeli capital as well.
Now, Mohsen, I mean, no disrespect intended to both Kosovo and Guatemala here, but not entirely heavy hitters. Do you see them opening a path to other, perhaps majority Muslim countries following suit?
Well, I think 100% Israel sees its new ties with this tiny Balkan country as part of its broader normalization with Arab and Muslim countries under agreements that were sponsored by the former US President Donald Trump. And I don't think that we're going to see Biden change that trajectory. So, yes, I'd say that it is very much, you know, something which will help Israel to actually soften up many of the other nations that it wants to flood Jerusalem. Because, of course, flooding Jerusalem with these international embassies gives them legitimacy to, in terms of declaring it is as completely annexed, completely theirs. The Palestinians have claimed East Jerusalem, which was captured by Israel in the 67 Six-Day War, and later annexed as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Most of the international community doesn't recognize the Israeli annexation of East Jerusalem and says the competing claims of the city should be resolved through negotiations. So clearly, Israel is making steps, step-by-step moves, to try and get Jerusalem annexed effectively, in my opinion.
Europe criticized this move, but there seems to be an underlining sense of tacit approval here, because if they wanted to make a song and dance about it, they could have, surely, Mohsen.
Well, the European Union did voice its regret in February at Kosovo's decision to open the embassy in Jerusalem, made as part of a broader deal brokered, as I said, by the United States. But this is typical of the EU. They'll do these lukewarm criticisms, but actually they're going to do nothing about it. The general position of the EU is that the Palestinian state should be based on the 1967 borders with land swaps. But the fact is that that whole concept has collapsed long ago. And what we've got is a belligerent Zionist state which wants to declare this as a sort of almost a theocratic nation now. They're pushing the Jewishness hard as another way of undermining Palestine. And the EU does nothing about this. The EU has really had a very toothless response to the entire problem. And it's I don't see it changing anytime soon. They defer to the Americans to lead on this. And, of course, that is another benefit for the Kosovans. They want the American money, probably want aid. And by cuddling up with Israel, they'll gain on that front as well.
Mohsen Abbas, as always, thank you. So some other news now, because a prominent Dutch black anti-racism politician who's called for the decolonization of education in the Netherlands is running in the country's next general election. Sylvana Simmons, a former television personality, formed the Anti-Racism and Discrimination Party, the BIJ1, back in 2016.
Being a Western country, obviously this is a great country to live in. There are many, many things to be grateful for. However, if your reality is that of a young black person in this country, what you'll find is that from the moment you enter school, you enter the systems, there is bias and prejudice. People have lower expectations of you. People judge you differently.
Voting in the Netherlands general election begins on Monday and is expected to last until Wednesday.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Ahmed Kabbalah, sometimes it does beggar belief. You would not recognize that we're in a global pandemic. by the reaction we're getting from some global communities on which medications could be helping the most amount of people.
Exactly, Amina. And Brazil has now taken Sputnik V vaccine from Russia, but it hesitated under pressure from Washington. And as you said, you think in a global health pandemic that we're all in this together, particularly as an outbreak in one part of the world can have detrimental effects on the whole globe. But yet, we saw pressure from Washington on Brazil in this document released by Brazil Wire, a investigative journalist called John McEnvoy. And what's startling about these revelations is it asks serious questions about Brazil's sovereignty and who Jair Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, is really answerable to. Is he answerable to the Brazilian people? Is he answerable to the White House? Or is he answerable to big Western multinational pharmaceutical companies? Now, some are also concerned because in the documents, it also revealed that there was pressure placed on Panama not to take Cuban doctors. Now, anyone that's been following the news surrounding COVID-19 over the last year would probably argue that Cuban doctors, in many people's eyes, have been the real heroes of this tragedy. They've been going around the world. They've even been going to relatively developed nations like Italy. Yet here we have countries that really could have done with some support being pressured by Washington and pressured by the United Kingdom and British mining companies, who tried to push forward the AstraZeneca vaccine ahead of Sputnik V. And now we are seeing complications with the AstraZeneca vaccine, with Germany being the latest country to say they're not going to use it because of concerns regarding blood clots. Now let's get the social media reaction to this story. So John McEnvoy, the guy that wrote this article, said 278,000 Brazilians have died from COVID-19. New documents show that the US pressured the Brazilian government not to buy the Russian vaccine, likely killing thousands of Brazilians. And another tweet says, for all the screeching about Russia using its vaccine, Sputnik V, as a soft power tool, it turns out the US has been arm-twisting governments behind the scenes not to use the Russian vaccine or accept Cuban assistance.
Now, Ahmed, could you think of a reason outside geopolitics and that whole fight for the sphere of influence that would explain why Washington would say to Brazil, one of the world's most populous nations and one of the countries that's been hit so terribly hard by this pandemic, to perhaps limit its options and limit the options for its people?
I can't think of a reason, but what seems clear to me is that while we're in this kind of new Cold War, it doesn't do the US's imperialist interest any favors if Russia is going around the world helping countries in the global south like it has with a vaccine rollout. But to scoot to this level, to put the lives of millions of people, and for Brazil to play along, is really, truly alarming. And some got to ask, the UK has the worst death toll in Europe. The US has the worst death toll in the world. Maybe the UK and the US could have done with Cuban doctors and Sputnik V, and maybe the death toll wouldn't be as high as it is today.
Wow, powerful questions there. I know what the answer from Washington and Westminster might well be, Ahmed Kabbalah. We'll leave it there, and we will leave you there, because that's all the time we have for this broadcast. Keep it locked. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Since its establishment, Human Rights Watch has consistently been criticized for being an agent of U.S. foreign policy, employing former U.S. government officials in key positions and displaying bias against governments unfriendly to the United States. We're prepared for you an article written by Alan McLeod, an academic and writer for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, under the heading Human Rights Watch Watches Out for U.S.'s Bolivian Friends, Condemns Amnesty for Political Prisoners. The article has been taken from MintPressNews.com website. Human Rights Watch has condemned a general amnesty for over 1,000 Bolivians persecuted under the one-year dictatorship of Jeanine Añez. Recently, the Washington-based human rights organization described a plan to drop all charges against people resisting the government as opening the door to impunity. Human Rights Watch's American director, José Miguel Vivanco, claimed that the new law undermines victims' access to justice and violates the fundamental principle of equality before the law. Human Rights Watch alleges that a handful of anti-coup demonstrators carried out serious crimes, such as arson or kidnapping, while opposing the regime, thus making general amnesty seriously problematic. New President Luis Arce won an overwhelming electoral victory in October, after a citizens' revolt paralyzed the country and forced Jeanine Añez to hold an election. Human Rights Watch notes with concern that this new decree suggests that anyone prosecuted by the Añez government for actions during social protests had their rights violated, something that many consider to be obvious and uncontroversial. Bolivian journalist Oli Vargas reacted by saying, Human Rights Watch is criticizing the Bolivian government for lifting the charges against leftists who were persecuted by the former coup regime. This is why Bolivians are suspicious of the United States' non-governmental organizations. A layperson might expect one of the supposedly best-known human rights organizations in the world to celebrate the acquittal of over 1,000 innocent people charged with crimes, such as reporting on massacres in a way that displeased the government, hospital workers treating the regime's victims, or calling Jeanine Añez a dictator in WhatsApp conversations. Yet Human Rights Watch strongly supported the coup as it was taking place, claiming that Former President Evo Morales was actually resigning of his own accord and merely traveling to Mexico rather than fleeing at the barrel of a gun. Human Rights Watch's Executive Director Ken Roth made a series of public statements on social media sites expressing his delight, even as security forces took over La Paz, massacring innocent civilians and overthrowing a democratically elected president, Evo Morales. Ken Roth also described the coup approvingly as an uprising and a transitional moment for Bolivia, whilst presenting Evo Morales as an out-of-touch strongman. For Ken Roth, Evo Morales was the casualty of a counter-revolution aimed at defending democracy against electoral fraud and his own illegal candidacy, falsely alleging that Evo Morales had ordered the army to shoot protesters. As Ken Roth was making his pronouncements, Jeanine Añez was signing a new law that gave security forces complete immunity for killing of dissenters. Human Rights Watch described this as a problematic decree, as if Jeanine Añez had merely used insensitive language. The organization also attempted to hide who were the perpetrators of the ensuing massacres, telling readers that 9 people died and 122 were wounded during a Cochabamba demonstration, but refusing to fill them in on who was dying and who was shooting. Even in the recent 2,800-word report published 16 months after the incident, the word coup is completely absent. Instead, Human Rights Watch claimed that Evo Morales was forced to resign on 10th of November 2019, after the commanders of the armed forces and the police asked him to step down. However, former President Morales made it clear at the time that he was leaving only to avoid a bloodbath. Human Rights Watch also continues to describe Jeanine Añez as the interim president, her own propagandist word for her role rather than a dictator, and maintains that Evo Morales' election was controversial because of allegations of electoral fraud. This is despite the fact that the allegations were immediately debunked by independent statisticians. Last month, Human Rights Watch demanded that former US President Donald Trump be prosecuted because he promoted false theories of a stolen election in the United States. Yet, in Bolivia, Human Rights Watch itself is doing exactly the same thing, and based on evidence which is just as shaky. Elected in 2005, Evo Morales was the first leader in Bolivia's history to come from its indigenous majority. During his 14 years in office, his administration reduced poverty by up to 42%. And reduced extreme poverty by up to 60%, halving unemployment in the country and increasing real gross domestic product per capita by up to 50%. Taking the country down a more socialist path, he fostered links to like-minded neighboring countries such as Ecuador, Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela, and was sharply critical of US actions abroad. In October of 2019, Evo Morales won a fourth term in office by over 10 percentage points. However, sectors of the US-backed Bolivian right-wing cried foul, alleging election fraud, with the military and the police using the ensuing chaos to justify overthrowing the elected president. The military handpicked Evo Morales' successor, Jeanine Añez, a little-known senator from a far-right political party that received a mere 4% of the votes cast. A hardline conservative, Jeanine Añez, sparked controversy by declaring the country's indigenous majority as satanic and arguing that they should not be allowed to live in cities. She immediately started crushing dissent, targeting followers of former President Morales, targeting media outlets and human rights observers. Añez also began privatizing the economy and reoriented the country's foreign policy away from an independent path and towards the policies of the United States. Despite calling herself an interim president, she repeatedly cancelled elections, leading many to believe she was attempting to stay in power indefinitely with the help from the military, which ruled the country directly for much of the 20th century. However, a nationwide general strike in August of last year shut the country down, forcing Jeanine Añez to agree to an election last October. Former President Evo Morales was banned from becoming a candidate and contesting this election, but Luis Arce, his former economy minister, was elected in a 27-point landslide victory, gaining almost twice the votes of his nearest rival. Unfortunately, this sort of behavior from Human Rights Watch is far from unusual. Headquartered in New York City, with a branch in Washington, D.C.'s Pennsylvania Avenue, the organization was originally established in 1978 as Helsinki Watch, an American group dedicated to exposing the crimes of Eastern Bloc countries and monitoring their compliance with the Helsinki Accords. Its founder, Arjen Nair, is a libertarian fundamentalist who equates the very idea of economic or labor rights with oppression, writing that they are profoundly undemocratic. Nair added, "Authoritarian power is probably a prerequisite for giving meaning to economic and social rights." Thus, under this interpretation of rights, the Evo Morales administration's actions in reducing poverty in Bolivia, in reducing hunger and labor insecurity, are not achievements at all, but rather black marks against the administration. Since its establishment, Human Rights Watch has consistently been criticized for being an agent of America's foreign policy, employing former U.S. government officials in key positions, and displaying bias against leftist governments unfriendly to the United States. Vivanco himself penned a much-derided report on human rights in Venezuela, which, in an open letter, over 100 Latin American experts and scholars claimed did not meet even the most minimal standards of scholarship, impartiality, accuracy, or credibility. And while constantly describing Venezuelan democratically elected leader Nicolas Maduro as a dictator, in May of last year, the head of Human Rights Watch, Vivanco, called Bolivia under Jeanine Añez a rule of democracy. Human Rights Watch worked hard to legitimize the American, British, and Brazilian-backed coups. With this new report, it appears as if it is still trying to turn the clock back, showing that it all too often places Western imperial interests over liberty for oppressed peoples.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I thought Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're on the topic of gluttony and eating too much, and we've mentioned this a few times now, by the way, so I don't need to repeat things that I've already discussed, like, for example, excessively eating brings about a hardening of the heart. We've mentioned that there are two things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala dislikes. It's been so much mentioned in the hadith that we come to understand that, you know, this really must be something very, very bad in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, where al-na'um, someone who excessively sleeps, al-akul, someone who excessively eats, these people have been pretty much condemned, you know, in the eyes of Islam. What a beautiful hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Adhibu ta'amakum, melt or destroy or get rid of your food, bidhikrillahi wa salah. Which basically means that through dhikrullah subhanahu wa ta'ala and through salah, you're going to be eating less. وَلَا تَنَامُ عَلَيْهَا, and don't sleep while you have food with you, which basically means sleeping with a full stomach. فَتَقْسُوا قُلُوبُكُمْ, or else your hearts will become hardened. And there are so many ahadith that speak in this line. From Nabiullah Isa, from Jesus alayhi salam, إِذَا أَكَلْتْ فَإِيَّاكَ أَن تَشْبَعِينَ, if you eat, then never ever become full. لِأَنَّ الطَّعَامِ إِذَا تَكَاثَرَ عَلَى الصَّدْرِ فَزَادَ فِي الْقَدْرِ ذَهَبَ مَاءُ الْوَاجِ. Because when you eat too much, it's going to affect your chest, it's going to affect your nafs, it's going to affect your soul. Then your stomach, for example, it's going to become hard, you're going to become heavy. Then it's going to remove or ruin or take away your dignity. ذَهَبَ مَاءُ الْوَجْهِ, basically, مَاءُ الْوَجْهِ, your abru, your مَاءُ الْوَجْهِ, pretty much basically means your honor, your dignity, your face value. Another hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, لَا تَرْفَعْ يَدَكَ مِنَ الطَّعَامِ إِلَّا وَأَنْتَ تَشْتَهِي. We know this very frequently mentioned hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he says, don't remove your hand from the food unless you continue to want it. So when you feel that you still want some more food, you withdraw yourself from eating. فَإِن فَعَلْتَ ذَلِكَ فَأَنْتَ تَسْتَمِرْهُ, and if you were to do so, then you will still feel that ladha, that passion, that pleasure of foods.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدری گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون. اینم هم امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Another hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he says, "Man qalla ta'amuhu sahha badana." Someone who eats less will have a healthier body. And from Imam al-Baqir, "Ma min shay'in abghad ila Allah 'azza wa jalla min batnin mamlu'." Imam al-Baqir says, peace be upon him, he says, "There's nothing worse in the eyes of God more than a full stomach. Ma min shay'in abghad ila Allah 'azza wa jalla min batnin mamlu'." So Sheikh Jawadi Amuli is mentioning these hadith one after the other and making sure that we understand that kind of sequence of what it is that we're leading to, where it all comes down to a person finding that balance where you're not only taking care of your physical health, your stamina, your natural need of eating, but you're also making sure that you don't become a person who is fixated, is obsessed with only food. And it's a really, really bad characteristic for a person to have. Which is exactly why, you know, we always hear those kind of reminders that, you know, when you look at your food, be thankful. Don't eat something hot. You know, don't waste. These kind of things are drilled in our minds for a purpose, of course. And for us to see food and water as something sacred. And that's why Sheikh Jawadi Amali mentions it again here. He says that the reason why Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi would sit jalsatul abd in the seating of a servant is because he saw food and wanted to show humbleness towards it. Qala, and a hadith was asked, why did he do this? Tawadu'an lillahi azza wa jal, as it says, as the hadith says in Al-Kafi. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.